Darkcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
In January 1977, over the course of 10 days, two men would reign terror in the area of Garden Grove in Orange, California. These men would be charged with 17 counts, including murder, robbery, burglary, auto theft, and attempted murder. But before they are caught, the crimes themselves would go unconnected. In this, the second part of a two-part series on Garden Grove, California, and crimes committed between December of 1976 and January 1977, we give details about multiple murderers, Mark Titch and Brett Thomas. Welcome to this episode of California True Crime. I'm Jessica, and I'm your host. With me are Charles and Sean. How are you guys?
Doing great.
Yeah, doing real good.
So this episode is part of a two-part series, and this is the second part. Normally, that means two episodes or more on a particular crime. This time, we're covering two crimes in the same area that definitely have some overlap, though they are committed by different people. Go back and listen to the first episode. I think it will help you to understand some of the things that we're going to talk about in this episode. The name of the episode is The Murder of Janet Stalkup. In order to put together this episode, I use newspapers and government documents. You can find a full list on our website at californiatruecrime.com. But these are crimes that are committed more regionally than in a particular city, and we'll kind of get into that in a minute. So information is spread throughout newspapers in Los Angeles and Orange County. And these crimes are mainly only covered, especially during the time that they happened, by local newspapers. They're covered to different degrees, but people who live in the area might actually remember these crimes. But outside Orange County, there's not very much attention on them specifically. This is also the first case I've covered that all of the crimes have taken place, not within a single city or even two cities, but throughout the entire county, and that county is Orange County, California. Orange County is a typical California county. You've seen, we've used the term densely suburban to describe cities before, but most of the places we talk about have very definable city lines, and in this case, that really isn't true. These cities like Garden Grove, which we talked about last episode, Orange, Anaheim, Costa Mesa, Irvine, Newport Beach, and a bunch of others, they're all part of Orange County, and this is really the definition of densely suburban. They're all smushed together, and while each city has its own culture and people, you can really drive in this area. Maybe you're going to Disneyland, or maybe you live there, and sometimes you won't even realize you've left one city and entered another. It's actually the second most densely populated county in California. San Francisco County is the first, but that's because San Francisco County is just basically the city of San Francisco. So, of course, it's going to be really densely populated.
And geographically, it's a lot smaller, too, when we're talking about, even though San Francisco, to some, may sound like a really big city, geographically speaking, it's really small comparatively.
Yeah, it's a pretty, by area,
yeah,
it's a pretty small county and city. And Orange County is actually pretty small. It's bigger than that, but pretty small as well, compared to some of the other counties that we've talked about, which are really huge, but people are more spread out.
Right.
Orange County is in Southern California and just south of Los Angeles. Long Beach sits right on its southwestern border, and it's also bordered by foothills of the Santa Ana Mountains. Most of the county is in a valley, but like a lot of the places we've talked about in California, there's a real big mix of geography between foothills and agricultural land and city. You've probably heard about this county because inside its borders are places like Disneyland, Knott's Berry Farms, and it's a common tourist location. But over 3 million people live in this county, and they just work, they go to school, they aren't visiting there, that's where their lives are. In 1977, when these crimes we're about to talk about take place, things were a little different. It's still densely suburban, and that will come into play, but there are less people living in the area at the time. In 1980, there are approximately 1.9 million people in Orange County. Did you guys have any like kind of Orange County fun facts or interesting things you wanted to share?
I looked up some stuff, mainly about music and stuff, and there's a lot of people we'd know about, like Jeff Buckley. He's from Anaheim, and an odd one to me is Horse the Band is actually from Lake Forest. But if we look at some of these, it really goes back to the late 90s and having some fun memories with how many of these certain bands are from the area, like Lit, Sugar Ray, Real Big Fish, The Vandals, The Offspring, and No Doubt. They're all from this area, and they're all very similar to me. So I found it interesting that it's all like really dense in this ska punk alternative from like the late 90s.
Well, and it's also a place too, correct me if I'm wrong, where you do have, with the densely populated area and the proximity to LA and a lot of these places, you do get a lot of famous people and people in media and the arts that live in this area as well.
Oh yeah, definitely.
One fun fact I found out about Orange County, which I thought was kind of neat, was that the writer Johnston McCulley, who you may know as the person who created Zorro, actually set his story in Orange County. It was in San Juan Capistrano, which is in Orange County at the time. Also, author Dean Koontz lives in Newport Beach.
I read that and just it got my attention that Steve Martin was born in Garden Grove and actually went to Garden Grove High School, where our victim attended in our last episode and where one of the victims in this episode actually went to school. So it's a huge place with so many ties. It's got a lot of agricultural land. It's got a lot of suburban areas, but it also Orange County sits, I mean, I think it had 40 miles of beachfront property, basically beaches. So, I mean, there's all different kinds of cultures.
And I think it is a place too, where if you're not familiar with California or you have an image of California, it is a very Californian place. I think it's a stereotypical Cal, you know, you have the beach, it's, you know, amusement parks plus agriculture and famous people. It's kind of like the perfect storm of California cliches.
On Friday, January 21st, 1977, a motorcyclist was traveling in an area described as Orange Villa Park in Orange, California. This motorcyclist came up upon a deceased body on the top of a hill about 300 yards from the nearest paved road. Orange is in the eastern part of Orange County and is just east of Garden Grove, California, and at the time, it had a population of about 90,000 people. The area where the body was found looked a little different than it does now. The newspaper says that the nearest intersection where the deceased body was found was Loma Street and Taft Street. According to Google Maps, these two streets are in the same general area, but they don't intersect. But looking at aerial views of 1977, it would seem this area was a lot less developed, and perhaps it intersected during that time. This area still has a lot of foothills and stuff that you can see when, we'll have some pictures up so you can kind of see what it looked like, but it does look quite different with more houses. The Orange Police Department is called, and they find the body of a young woman on the top of a rural hill and near an old dump site. According to newspapers at the time, the woman was fully clothed, she had a rosary clasped in her hands, and she had been shot three times, once in the shoulder and twice in the face. Orange police didn't recognize the woman, and there wasn't any identification or a purse or vehicle at the scene to help identify her. They processed the scene, but the first thing detectives need to do is to try and find the identification of the woman. At the police station, they go through missing persons reports, and when that doesn't narrow down a possible ID, they begin to contact neighboring cities' police. This is an area where each police department is responsible for investigating crimes, but also the cities are so closely connected that crime can spill over, and this victim could easily be from somewhere nearby.
I find that interesting because a lot of times you watch shows or hear stories of how the police departments don't want to help each other out. And this one, you know, they call and, hey, can you help me out here? And I find that interesting. Maybe because they are so close, like you said.
Well, I think that seems like such a trope, too, we see on TV. Like you said, Sean, all the time is that it's my jurisdiction. But you would think that because they're so close, that they would have to have a pretty good working relationship back and forth because of that, just that very same fact of those overspillage.
I kind of think of, you know, more famous cases like Zodiac, where there were Vallejo and different areas, but they didn't communicate with each other. So they didn't really connect them at first. Mm-hmm. And then they, I don't know if they really didn't want to help each other, but, you know, back in this time, you didn't have like up-to-date, quick ways to identify. So it's, you know, paperwork and phone calls. So it might be a little harder.
Yeah. Or messaging, you know, you actually had to like put something in the mail to get it some, I mean, you had teletype machines and, but they weren't prevalent. They're not everywhere, you know, no faxes.
Yeah. It hasn't come up in our episodes in not least in anything that we've seen where the, you know, police are fighting each other, but I know that's a pretty prevalent thing on TV and movies. And in the Zodiac cases you're talking about, in the documentary we watched on Night Stalker, which I believe is on Netflix, there was some of that there. Not as much, but it was more like what you're saying, Sean. Crimes committed in these individual cities, people just didn't talk to each other. There wasn't that
right
process for doing so. So yeah, it always, you know, and there are always things happening behind the scenes that we don't see. So it's just possible that we haven't come upon it yet, which hopefully bodes well for a lot of cases.
Well, it seems too that it's a failure of communication, not necessarily because it's unwilling to communicate. It's just they didn't have the means or the opportunity. It seems like every time we've talked about the police working with other agencies, whether it's, you know, a federal agency, another state agency, it seems like everybody's pulling together for the same reason.
And as it turns out, the Garden Grove Police Department has a missing person report that was just filed that morning by the parents of a young woman in their city. Her name was Laura Ann Stoughton, and she was 20 years old. It becomes clear that this is the name of the victim on the hill in Orange, California. According to the report filed that Friday morning, before a motorcyclist came upon the murdered body of Laura Stoughton, her family had awoken and found their daughter was not at the family home where she was supposed to be. The day before, on January 20th, 1977, Laura Stoughton went to work her last shift at El Torito in Newport Beach, California. Newport Beach is southwest of Garden Grove, where Stoughton lived with her parents. It's about 20 miles away, and she worked at El Torito for a year while going to school part-time at Long Beach City College. El Torito is actually a California restaurant, and most of the restaurants are here in California. I didn't really realize this would be maybe a restaurant people hadn't heard of if they don't live here. There's a handful in other countries and a couple of other states, but this is a restaurant that started as a bar and then became a Mexican food restaurant here in California. That Thursday, Stoughton worked an evening shift, and then according to her manager, she changed out of her work uniform and into street clothes before meeting up with friends at the Registry Hotel in Costa Mesa. There they spent time at what was described as both a bar and a club in the hotel. The Registry Hotel opened in 1976 and is no longer a hotel there, but it was right next to the Orange County Airport. That's now called the John Wayne Airport, and this was a massive hotel. Not only was it state-of-the-art, but at the time it had 306 rooms, as well as meeting places for 8 to 1,200 people. Room service ran 24 hours a day. There was a pool, a sunning area. They had tennis during the day and night, that was in their ad, a lobby bar, a saloon, and a 24-hour restaurant called the Gazebo. A lot of these places that we're going to talk about have varying addresses, or the city that they're in is varying, but they're all along MacArthur Boulevard, along the Orange County airport. So the El Torito is actually in this very same area, despite its address being a little, it makes it sound like it's in another city altogether, and it is, but a lot of those barriers, as I said, they come up right next to each other.
You're not traveling from one city to another. It's just like literally on the other side of the block is entirely different city.
Yeah, and this area was known as a place you could go to, and there were a lot of things to do. There were several restaurants, a couple of hotels, just bars, that kind of thing. So this was a typical hangout spot, it sounded like. Laura Stoughton was described as pretty and stylish with brown hair. On the night after her shift, she was wearing tangerine-colored denim slacks, brown leather earth shoes with blue socks over knee-high nylons, and a lace belt. She also had on a white muslin blouse and a brown wool tweed sweater that wrapped around her body. On her right hand, she wore a spoon ring and a small white gold one on the left. Her manager at El Torito said that Stoughton was a, quote, once-in-a-million type person, and that she was primarily interested in church and family. According to witnesses, at 1:30 a.m., she left the hotel alone and drove away in her metallic brown Volkswagen Beetle, and she headed home. She should have arrived at her home with her parents on Seacrest Circle in Garden Grove at approximately 2 a.m. Investigators believe that she was abducted from out in front of her home and put into another vehicle. Her car is found outside in the driveway a few hours later, the following morning, by her family, and they make a report that she's missing. Once Orange and Garden Grove police speak, they're able to identify Laura Stoughton as the murdered body on the hill on the edge of Orange, California, but they aren't sure what the motive is for her murder. An autopsy will reveal that she was shot in the shoulder, perhaps from behind as she was moving or running away, and that she was also shot twice in the face as she was sitting or kneeling on the ground. She was shot with a .22 caliber semi-automatic rifle. At the time, newspapers will say that she wasn't sexually assaulted. In 2015, the Orange County District Attorney will send a letter opposing parole for one of the men who murdered her. And in that letter, there are more details given about the crime. And one of those details is that Stoughton was raped by the two men who were eventually arrested and pled guilty. And that when her body was found, it was in much different shape than what the newspaper reports that the police tell them. She does have, one of the main details is that she does have her rosary in her hands, though.
So why would there be two different reports? Like, why the difference in how the state of her was reported?
I'm not really sure why the details are different. I just know that they are. And throughout the month or a month and a half it takes for them to solve this case, they continually say that sexual assault was not the motive for that crime. Stoughton's purse was not found at the scene, nor in her vehicle at her home. Investigators asked the public for help, and one of the things they're looking for is her purse. Interestingly, this purse is really more like small luggage. It's a blue Samsonite travel-type shoulder bag. She carried her identification, but also her clothes in this bag, and they aren't able to find things like her El Torito outfit. So everything she had, her ID, all of her personal belongings are all in this bag, which makes sense for someone who's, you know, working in different cities and going to school in Long Beach. She's probably constantly on the move, so she's carrying those things with her.
Right. You carry more stuff than somebody would normally do on a daily basis.
Investigators are also asking for anyone who is in Northeast Orange between the times of 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. on that Friday to contact them, especially if they witnessed anything. They're focused on the area of Taft and Tustin Avenue and Taft and Loma Avenue. As well as all the usual investigative methods, police also reenact the possible crime on the hill. They do so using a female police officer that fits the description of Stoughton. From this recreation, they use bullet trajectories to try to get a better picture of the person or persons responsible for this crime. They believe that it was someone between 5 feet and 8 inches and 6 feet tall. They also believe there may have been more than one assailant. There isn't a lot of information released about the murder, and it does appear that they're hopeful someone has witnessed something. Orange police are responsible for investigating this crime, and they put a lot of resources on this case. They have 8 investigators, 2 sergeants, and an analyst working 18 to 20 hours a day just on this case. They're talking to people she knew, people she worked with, people she went to school with. They also have tips come in from 2 psychics, and they utilize a clinical psychologist. One of the reasons there's so much effort put into this case is because it could possibly be connected to the murder of Janet Stalkup. This happened a month earlier on December 19th, 1976. This is the murder that we talked about last episode. In that crime, Saul Cupp goes missing after leaving her apartment on the 19th. She's missing for almost a full week before she is found murdered. And the similarities between the two victims, they lead to the possibility that their murders are connected. So just to kind of go over them again, they have a similar look. They're both from Garden Grove. They both knew each other, having gone to the same high school. And they're both around the same age. But there isn't any physical evidence to really connect these two crimes at the time. There's also, in the Saul Cupp case, an earlier case of kidnapping and rape that happened just a few weeks before that December crime in the same apartment complex that she had lived in. Again, there's not specific connection between that crime, Saul Cupp's crime, and this crime, but they are similar crimes. In the last episode, we also talked about the murder of Robin Cox in Costa Mesa. That's brought up specifically in the newspapers more here because Robin Cox has similarities to Stoughton. They were both waitresses, and they both hung out and spent time on MacArthur Boulevard. So they think the possibility that all those cases could be connected, but those two in particular have some eerie connections as well.
I understand, though. That makes sense. Like we talked about last episode, you're looking for any clues, any evidence, and so you can't overlook the fact that there are a lot of coincidences connecting these women.
And I think it's also harder. Just it's, you know, the 70s. You didn't have Big Brother and cameras and all that stuff. Right. So you do need like kind of a stretch for anything to just find it.
No friends. I mean, you do have forensics, but it's limited to like hair and fiber and blood type.
Right.
You know, there's no DNA yet. So yeah, I think any rational person would do the same thing. Hey, look, we have these women. They all kind of look the same. You know, a few of them are from the same area. We have to look at the possibility that this is a, you know, serial criminals.
Especially, I think, because we know how rare it is for someone you don't know to have murdered you. We've talked about that before. The other thing is that kidnapping is extraordinarily rare as a crime on its own. It's just so rare to happen to people. And here you have, you know, three women who are really kind of similar, overlapping lives, and they've all been kidnapped. It's frustrating that, on the one hand, that they're not connected because that's terrifying, but I can understand why police have to look at it.
Right.
They never really say for sure they're all connected. They make sure, like in other crimes we've covered, to, you know, they're just meeting and talking about it. Mm-hmm. And these are the four cases that they mentioned in the newspaper. But I know there are other cases that they look at that are happening at the same time. There are even more murders of young single women in this area of Orange County and Los Angeles that appear kind of similar at the time. So they don't find anything to connect them all, but I think it's important that they look at them.
Well, and we've talked too about, you know, the 1970s in California was a horrific time for serial killers, for you know, young people disappearing. There's a ton of factors that go into that. So I can imagine being a police officer. I can't imagine. I can sympathize, you know, with the idea that you're a police officer at this time, seeing all these other terrible things go on around you in other jurisdictions and other cities, and hoping that it doesn't happen. But now you have what seems to be a pattern appearing, you know, doing whatever you can to make sure that you take in all the data possible.
Hello, and welcome to The Jury Room. I'm your host, Kevin, and I will be covering anything true crime, from serial killers to cold cases, and everything in between. The Jury Room podcast is available on most major podcasting platforms. Don't forget to like, subscribe, follow anywhere you can. Stay safe. And thanks for listening.
Investigators would eventually realize that these three murders were tragic coincidences, but were not related. And I just want to say here that giving you all this information might sound like it took weeks and weeks and weeks for them to come up with if they were connected or not, or come up with information that might lead them. And in fact, this happens over a very short amount of time, just a couple of weeks, in fact. So just so people kind of have a better idea about how long these murders take. Janice Saul Cupp's as if you listened to last episode, takes, you know, 45 years to solve. But these other ones that do get solved the timeline isn't as long as it makes it seem in this episode.
We're really thinking like less than a month.
Yeah, about a month, yeah. So while these murders are unconnected, the murderers in Stoughton's case would continue to commit more crimes. On Monday, January 24th, 1977, Ephraim T. Christian was working at the Sunrise Drive-In Dairy in Garden Grove, California. Christian, who was 35 years old, was from India, and he co-owned the drive-in at 9782 Catella Avenue. At 7:40 p.m., a customer went inside the drive-in to pay for gas. They were getting it at the self-service pump, and they found Christian murdered near a locked cash register. He had been shot twice in the face with a .22 caliber rifle. Investigators quickly determined that Christian was murdered in a botched robbery attempt. While they don't say how they come by this information, they tell the public that two men robbed the station, and they even put out a description of one of the suspects. The description they gave was for a 20-year-old of Latin descent who was 5 feet 9 inches tall and 135 to 140 pounds, with collar-length straight hair, dark trousers, and a dark blue Eisenhower-type jacket. The suspect was believed to be driving a getaway car that was a dirty white station wagon that could have been a Chevelle.
I've never heard the term Eisenhower jacket. What is that?
The Eisenhower jacket, or sometimes it's called an Ike jacket, it's kind of a field military look. It's usually all over drab and made out of wool, and it was really developed for the U.S. Army during the late stages of World War II, and then it's named after Dwight Eisenhower. Yeah, it looks like if you've seen, it's kind of the outer jacket of a military uniform. Imagine World War II soldiers, you know, kind of in their dress jackets. But it was intended to be kind of an insulating jacket outside of their regular uniform.
It's really the jacket I think of when I think of him. I don't know why, but it hits higher, right? On the...
Yeah, it hits right at the waist.
We'll have a picture on our website because it is kind of hard to describe exactly what it looks like. There isn't a connection drawn between this crime and Stoughton's murder at this time. In part, this is because two different police departments are responsible for investigating each crime, but also because, on first glance, they appear like very different crimes. The Sunrise Drive-In Dairy was less than 2 miles from the Stoughton family home, which is believed to also be where Stoughton was kidnapped. Christian's murder would take place just 4 days after Stoughton's. On Saturday, January 29th, 1977, 48-year-old Aubrey Duncan left the Q and Cushion Family Billiard Center at 10576 Magnolia Avenue in Stanton, California. Stanton is a smaller town in Orange County, and it only has about 37,962 people living there in 2020, so it's probably smaller at the 70s. It is just 5 miles northwest of Garden Grove, California, and 7 miles west of Anaheim. Duncan, who was a father of four, owned the billiard center along with a coin-operated laundromat, and that night he took his receipts and approximately $1,200 with him, and he left for his home after 2 a.m. His home on Villare Street was less than a mile from his business, but as he approached his front door, investigators believed he was ambushed by two men attempting to rob him. The men shot at Duncan in what was described as a hail of gunfire. Later, it will be determined that Duncan was shot in the back with a shotgun and a small caliber rifle. Neighbors heard the shots, as well as his wife, Nadine, and his 18-year-old daughter, Denise. They were both inside the home. The two of them opened the door to the home and were struck by bullets. When police got to the scene, they found Aubrey Duncan already deceased. His daughter, Denise, was rushed to the hospital and had been shot 3 times, once in the heart. She was pronounced dead a few hours later. Nadine, Aubrey's wife, was also taken to West Anaheim Community Hospital, and she was in stable condition. She would live through the ordeal that took two members of her family. Two of Duncan's daughters were inside the home and quote-unquote unharmed, though the law doesn't take into account the harm of living through this crime and losing your loved ones takes. The scene was overly violent, with neighbors saying they heard 6 to 7 gunshots. Employees of Aubrey Duncan didn't understand why someone trying to rob him would need to resort to murder. According to them, Duncan always said that if he was robbed, he would just give up the money. You could make more money. It wasn't worth your life. Investigators knew the motive for this crime, but they didn't initially connect it to Christian's murder at the drive-in or Staunton's murder in Orange, California, at least if not publicly, if they were even considering it. The Duncan home was only about 2 miles from the Sunrise Drive-in Dairy, and this was just days after Christian's murder. On January 31st, 1977, a city employee of Orange, California, found Staunton's blue shoulder bag in a culvert on the northeast section of town. It was several miles from the crime scene, and it didn't look like anything was missing. They tested the purse for prints, but if they found some, that isn't released to the public. Investigators also believe that the purse wasn't haphazardly tossed, but purposefully put into the culvert and covered up in order to hide. After Staunton's purse is found, investigators tell the public that they no longer think her murder is connected to the murder of Janet Stalkup, and they seem more convinced that the motive is robbery. Again, why they believe this specifically isn't really given to the public.
It's very interesting how they take a purse, stick it in the culvert, and cover it up to hide, but they blatantly just destroy the Duncan family and their house, and neighbors hear it. They just seem to be all over the place of what they're doing. Why hide a purse when you're just going to shoot up a home very loudly? And it's just odd to me.
From what I know, after they're caught, I will say that each crime seems like an escalation in crime.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Prior to this, there's no information if they had hurt someone else, murdered someone else, as it were. So I think that first murder of Laura Staunton kind of begins this much more violent crime.
That's another interesting point, how the escalation was so fast.
Yeah.
They do that with Laura, and then it's not much later to the Duncan family, and that escalation is very fast.
It really is. Yeah, it happens just over the course of about a week or so. Each of these murders is devastating and violent. They're also not happening in a vacuum. There are a series of very violent robberies of victims' homes going on at the time in this area. Some of these will be connected to these crimes eventually, but if police have connected them now or consider them possibly connected, that information, again, isn't given to the public. Of course, in all of these cases we've covered, the police are asking for witnesses to come forward. On February 1st, 1977, everything would change in these investigations. On that day, a CHP officer saw a broken-down, abandoned vehicle on the side of Interstate 15 near Victorville, California, at 8 p.m. The car was a 1976 Chevrolet Monte Carlo, and when they checked the car's license plate, they found that vehicle had been stolen in Anaheim, California, on January 16, 1977. That would be just 5 days before Laura Staunton was kidnapped and murdered. Victorville is a city east of Los Angeles and in San Bernardino County. It sits on the edge of the Mojave Desert. Interstate 15 is one we've talked about before, I believe in the Houston episode. It comes out of San Diego and moves up through the western United States, going through Nevada, Utah, Idaho, and Montana. It's a road you can take and hit a lot of different states and go a lot of different places. The CHP officer called in other officers, and on their way, they spotted two men walking down the interstate attempting to hitchhike. CHP stopped the men and questioned them about the vehicle. It turned out the men had a history of criminal behavior. One was Brett Matthew Paul Thomas, who was 18 years old at the time, and the other was Mark Titch, who was a juvenile and 17. Titch, it turned out, had just escaped the California Youth Authority in San Diego. He had done that in November of 1976, so just a couple of months before these crimes began.
I was just wondering, did it say why he was in there in the first place? I know it's juvenile.
It didn't, no. And there's actually not too much information about Mark Titch given pretty much ever in articles,
okay,
especially back then, and I think because he's a juvenile. CHP asked them if they knew anything about the vehicle, and initially they said that they didn't know. They just didn't know what the car or anything about it. As CHP continued to question them, they changed their story, and they said they were kidnapped from Anaheim. Their stories just didn't really match up, and CHP officers placed both Titch and Thomas under arrest. Then they called Anaheim police to let them know they had a man and a juvenile under arrest for grand theft auto, and the police in that city sent officers to pick up and formally arrest the two men. At some point, either the CHP or the police from Anaheim look in the trunk of the stolen Monte Carlo. A Monte Carlo is a really 1970s vehicle. It's a two-door vehicle with a very large trunk. Inside, what they find is evidence of far worse crimes than stealing a vehicle. The trunk held a stash of weapons, including a shotgun, a rifle, and several pistols. And amongst the weapons, there was also blood and human hair. The weapons and the state they're found in are disturbing. But when they look into Thomas and Titch further, they find they had been living in Stanton, California, in an apartment complex on Magnolia Street and Cerritos Avenue. This apartment complex is well known to police because it's dangerous and a common place for criminals to be and for criminal activity to take place. At the time, police referred to the apartment complex as, quote, the zoo. This apartment complex was also right in the heart and not from where the four murders took place, but also close to where a host of robberies where people were held at gunpoint in their homes happened. The guns found in the trunk were also a match for types of weapons used by the perpetrators. And the apartment complex was actually less than a block from the pool hall where Aubrey Duncan worked. Police continued to interrogate the two men, and at the time the public isn't told whether or not the two men confess, but they do say they can connect them to the murders of Laura Staunton, Aubrey Duncan, Denise Duncan, and Ephraim Christian, and the attempted murder of Nadine Duncan, as well as at least 8 violent robberies. Having this information gives police a better idea of what happened to each of the victims in Titch and Thomas's crime spree. The kind of robberies these men committed were terrifying in their own right. They would show up on the doorstep of what police believed was just a randomly picked home in the middle of the night when everyone was asleep, usually between 1 and 4 a.m. They each had guns, and they would just knock on the door. When the inhabitants answered the door, they forced their way in. They committed several of these robberies in or around the home of Laura Staunton on Seacrest Circle. After learning about the way the men operated, the police believe that when Staunton went home that night, she probably drove up and parked in her driveway and interrupted the two men as they were getting ready to either rob her home or one nearby. Investigators believe it's likely they tried to force her at gunpoint to let them into her home where her family slept, and that when she refused, they kidnapped her. They believe the motive for her murder was so she could never identify them. That act ramped up their crime spree, and when they attempted to rob Ephraim Christian at the drive-in dairy, it also appeared that he refused to give them money. As a response, they murdered him. In the 2015 letter to the parole board by the Orange County District Attorney, it's also stated that after they murdered Christian, they tried to force open the cash register, but were unable to do so and eventually left the scene. The attack at the Duncan home was even more of an escalation, as investigators believe Aubrey Duncan and his family were ambushed. In the same letter by the Orange County DA, it's noted that the two men knew of the Q and Cushion and they live less than a block from this business. They staked out both the site and Aubrey Duncan with a pair of binoculars and followed him from his business to his house on the night of the murders. While Duncan walked to his front door, he was shot by Thomas with a .22 caliber rifle, and as he lay dying, Titch took the keys to the Q and Cushion off the victim's belt. When the front door opened, Thomas continued firing. The two ran to their vehicle, and as they drove away, Thomas used a shotgun and continued firing at the front door from the passenger seat of the car. According to the letter, Titch asked Thomas why he did this, and Thomas said, quote, "I was just making sure I was finishing up the job." He would also tell police that he did it out of instinct. Thomas and Titch went to rob the Q and Cushion, but were unable to do so when someone pulled up to the business. The motive for all of these murders will be stated as them not wanting to leave witnesses, but I think that doesn't fully encompass all the terrible things they did or even how they did them, especially after learning about them. Police also find that another crime, this time outside of Orange County and in National City, is connected to at least one of the men under arrest. Mark Titch, the one who has escaped juvenile detention in San Diego, is tied to a liquor store robbery on December 27, 1976. He committed that crime with a different man named William Hapu, who was 19 years old at the time. Apparently, the two men tried to rob a liquor store, and a San Diego police officer responded to the scene. He saw them running away, and he tried to stop them. He gave chase, and they opened fire on him. He was struck by 5 bullets, but survived. It's noted that they didn't get, quote, significant loot from this robbery. And I also don't know who shot the bullets that actually hit the officer. They never say. Brett Thomas and Mark Titch are booked on 17 counts of murder, robbery, burglary, auto theft, and attempted murder. Thomas is 18, so he's held at Anaheim jail while they await their first hearings. But since Titch is 17 years old, he's sent to Orange County Juvenile Hall, and one of the first things prosecutors have to work out is if they're going to charge him as a juvenile or as an adult. I think attempted murder is a phrase with a lot of burden here because Nadine Duncan, who was shot but not killed during this crime, suffered greatly. She was shot 3 times with a rifle. According to her victim impact statement in 2015, one of the shots barely missed her heart, another pierced her diaphragm in 2 places, and one hit her spleen. She also suffered 187 birdshot pellets from the shotgun in her legs. And of course, she lost her husband and daughter. A hearing is held to decide whether Mark Titch would be tried as an adult. There's no bail set for him while that process is happening. Bail is set for Brett Thomas at $1 million. Initially, he pleads not guilty to the charges. After the hearing is concluded, it's decided that Titch will be tried as an adult, and a $1 million bail is also set for him. The decision came down to the severity of the charges, which we've talked about before, made juvenile court an unfit place to try him. There weren't even really laws in the books that would have covered this. Both men are held at the Orange County Jail. At this time in California, the death penalty had been deemed unconstitutional under California law. And even though that will change later in 1977 and by vote in 1978, when it comes to these crimes, that's off the table. As is life without the possibility of parole, something that will also change, but here, that isn't a possible sentence. We'll never receive information on why they committed the crimes they did, if that even exists, and never a defense for their actions, because both men plead guilty to the charges in lieu of a trial and are sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole. Brett Thomas specifically confessed to being the shooter in the murder of Ephraim Christian, Aubrey Duncan, and Denise Duncan, and the attempted murder of Nadine Duncan. Mark Titch confessed to killing Laura Stoughton. They have been denied parole several times throughout the years. In a 2015 parole hearing, there was also evidence that Thomas had continued his criminal behavior while inside prison, violating 60 rules. The district attorney listed them in the letter he sent to the parole board, asking them to deny his parole. It's a long laundry list with many issues. Some of them seem more important than others, but some of them involved violence, refusing to follow orders, refusing to work, drug violations, as well as participating in a, quote, well-known white supremacist gang. Brett Thomas has never been paroled. There's less information on Mark Titch and what happened to him after he was caught and put in prison, but he did die in prison in 2014. At the 2015 parole hearing of Brett Thomas, the remaining victims of this crime spree were able to speak or write letters, sharing with the parole board their experiences and reasons why they shouldn't vote for parole. Their words are a lasting reminder of the way violent crime fractures lives and creates enduring pain for those who live on. Laura Stoughton's sister, Karen, wrote many things in her letter, but one really stuck out to me. She wrote, quote, "When I think of a timeline of my life, there are 2 main periods, before January 1977 and after." This is a good reminder that while we've talked many times in our episodes about the family's ability to heal or to move on, to gain closure, this is really a simplistic viewpoint of what they actually experience. These kinds of crimes change paths, and they aren't just the ending of one life, but of many. But that new life doesn't mean that the pain ends or that the fight for continued justice goes away. Lynette Duncan, now an adult, but the younger sister to Denise Duncan and daughter to Aubrey Duncan, also spoke about her experience and against paroling Thomas. According to her, on the night she lost her father and sister, she also experienced the hardest thing she's ever had to do. She had to tell her younger sister, then 11, that their father and older sister had been murdered and their stepmother had been shot. Quote, There's so much pain that you can't even imagine. Whenever we have a parole hearing, I have to relive that pain all over again. But like so many family members who never had a choice in the events that took their loved ones away and changed the trajectories of their lives, Lynette Duncan vowed, "I will continue to appear at every parole hearing until he dies or I do." Reading the cold case for this episode is Charles.
In 1980, Carrie Patterson was 15 years old and had just moved with her family to Fullerton, California from Cerritos, California. On June 26, 1980, she left her home to meet with friends from Cerritos at an ice cream parlor in Fullerton, known as the Ice Cream Castle. It was approximately a mile from her home. After the meeting, one of her friends gave her a ride home on his bicycle. He left her near her home and continued on his way. This was the last time she was seen, her family reporting her missing soon after. On December 27, 1980, Carrie's skull, her femur, and two other bones were found near Tonner Canyon near the 57 freeway. This area was 12 miles from where she was last seen. Her cause of death is undetermined by Orange County sheriffs, who are asking the public for any information regarding this murder. In 2020, a witness who was in the area at the time of the disappearance came forward to see they saw a man in the area at the time. This witness was able to help create a composite sketch. The sketch has been released, and the man is considered another possible witness at this time. Sheriffs need anyone who recognizes the man or knows anything about the disappearance and murder of Carrie Patterson to come forward. If you have any information about this case, please call Cold Case Sheriff Detective Bob Taft at area code 714-647-7045 or email coldcase@ocsheriff.gov. Anonymous tips can be submitted at area code 855-TIP-OCSS.
Thank you for listening to this episode of California True Crime on the Darkcast Network. For a full list of sources, as well as more information on the case, head over to our webpage at californiatruecrime.com, where you can support the show by joining our Patreon, which has the option of ad-free episodes. Our web store is up and running with some new California True Crime merchandise, such as t-shirts, mugs, and special episode exclusive stickers. If you'd like to contact us, you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Cali True Crime. Make sure that you subscribe to our show to get our latest episodes. Leave us a 5-star review or tell a friend to get the word out about California True Crime. We'd like to thank our quality control engineer, Melanie Duncan. This was recorded at Snail Ranch Studios and The Hangar. This has been a production of JCS Inc.